This is The Beat, a podcast series that keeps you in the know about the latest community policing topics facing our nation.
Hello and welcome. My name is Dr. Deborah Rachel McCullough, and on behalf of the COPS office, I would like to introduce you to the topic of eyewitness misidentification, how it happens, and the impact on the innocent. This podcast will be a two-part podcast. The first will explore a DNA and exoneration case that was based upon misidentification of Marvin Anderson. The second part will be with Dr. Jennifer Dysart, focusing on practical information for law enforcement. Dr. Jennifer Dysart is an associate professor of psychology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, and has been conducting research on eyewitness identification for 15 years. Her research examines how police identification procedures can lead to the mistaken identification of innocent people and how the implementation of safeguards may reduce these errors. Let's talk first with Marvin Anderson. Hello, Marvin, and thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Hello, how are you doing?
Could you tell us a little bit about your case, what you were convicted of, and how many years you spent behind bars for a crime you did not commit?
In 1982, I was sent to trial for two counts of rape, sodomy, robbery, and abduction, and was sentenced in March by 80 for a total of 210 years. I spent 15 years incarcerated, 5 years on parole, and the sexual offender program.
And what impact has that wrongful conviction had on your life and your family?
A huge impact. Like I said, that's 20 years of my life that was actually taken away from me. You know, that's 20 years that I can no longer retrieve or get back, or began to get back. Once I came home, I kind of picked up and just tried to move forward with my life, but not giving up on trying to prove my innocence. Until that happened, there were certain crutches I had to live by. Couldn't be around my family that had younger kids because I was a sex offender. As far as my family, there was things that we just couldn't do as a family because of my crime.
Marvin, what do you think led to the misidentification of your case?
In my case, it was very unique because the victim was shown several sets of mugshots. And in that array of mugshots that she was shown, the law officers achieved a photo ID for my job, which was a color ID. And each time that they showed her the mugshot, my ID was in each different set. And the mugshot that they showed her, all of them were in black and white, with the exception of my one ID picture, which was in color. Each time, you know, you keep seeing different mugshots, but this one particular color ID or mugshot keep appearing, it gives vision in your mind that why, you know, I keep seeing the same face that's sticking out. And in a sense, it gave her the impression that, you know, there's a reason for this one picture keeps showing up. And that's what led to her misidentification of me.
Is there anything that law enforcement could have done differently to prevent this from happening in your case?
There was a lot of things that law enforcement could have done to prevent what happened to my case. One, they got stuck on what we call it nowadays tunnel vision. They mainly just focused their attention and the case surrounding just on me. When there was another suspect that was involved, and actually he was the real perpetrator of my case, they never focused on him, even with all the information that the community and my family and attorney gave the law enforcement about did this crime. They just focused their attention directly on me.
How do you feel about law enforcement now?
I'm asked that question right off. I believe in our law and our justice system 100%. We need our laws, we need rules and regulations. However, I do have somewhat of a problem because it's the people that enforce these rules and regulations that we're supposed to trust and believe and have faith in. That's not always honest and trustworthy. We are human, we do make mistakes, but there are law enforcement that's out here in our community that doesn't work and operate that way. I believe in the laws and rules and regulations that we have for society as a whole, 100%. I just don't trust the individual that enforce the law.
Thank you so much, Marvin, for sharing your experience with us. And I'd like to now turn to Dr. Dysart. Doctor, what are some of the factors that can lead to misidentifications?
Researchers have been examining eyewitness misidentification really for about 35 years now. And what we understand is that eyewitnesses make mistakes for two kind of main reasons, two categories. First, they make mistakes because of things that just happened at the crime scene, things that are related to the witness. Did they get a good view? Were there multiple perpetrators? Were they tired or intoxicated at the time of the event? And the second group of categories or reasons why witnesses make mistakes are the procedures that law enforcement use to essentially collect the evidence from the eyewitness. What the questions are that they ask them during the interview, how they go about choosing the photographs to put into the photo array, what questions do they ask after an identification. We understand that all of those things influence an eyewitness.
What can be done within the criminal justice system, then, to enable more reliable and accurate identifications?
There are a series of recommendations or reforms that eyewitness researchers have come through decades of research to understand will reduce the likelihood of a misidentification. The first is, how do law enforcement choose the photographs to put into the lineup or photo array that they're going to show an eyewitness? So the selection of the fillers or the foils in the procedure is extremely important. And we recommend that the law enforcement officer doing this uses the witness's description in order to pick out the fillers and not take a photograph of the suspect and match photographs to the suspect. The second is that witnesses should be warned prior to viewing the photo array that the actual perpetrator may or may not be shown. In addition, other warnings are recommended, such as individuals may change in appearance slightly from photographs in real life, so you might expect changes in hairstyle, beard, those types of things. In addition, witnesses should be told essentially not to worry that if they don't make an identification that their case will be over, right? So not to have any pressure on the witness to make a selection during the identification procedure. The third reform is double-blind administration or blind administration, and that is where the officer who's conducting the identification procedure doesn't know who the suspect is in that identification procedure. And this ensures that there's no hint to the eyewitness who the suspect might be, therefore increasing the reliability of the identification. And fourth, we recommend that instead of showing all of the photos or images at the same time in your typical six-pack or throwdown, that instead the individuals in the photo array or in the lineup are presented one person at a time in sequence, which is referred to as a sequential identification procedure.
How will the reforms you are promoting impact the number of correct identifications that are made?
This is a great question that I'm asked when I do trainings with colleagues across the country, because, of course, law enforcement want to ensure that when they have the right person who committed the crime in the procedure, that the witness is still able to make an identification, a positive identification. And the answer is a little complicated. First, in essence, it's important to remember that the criminal justice system needs to rely on reliable witnesses that have strong memories of the perpetrator. And so if an eyewitness has a strong memory, a very good look at the person, it shouldn't matter whether or not the images in the photo array are presented one at a time or all at the same time. It shouldn't matter for the identification if the witness is informed that the actual perpetrator may or may not be there. When the witness recognizes the person who committed the crime, they will still pick that person. Where it becomes complicated is when witnesses don't have strong memories of the actual perpetrator, and these various recommendations have been shown to reduce choosing and reduce guessing in eyewitness identification studies. So in the end, if you're going to reduce guessing, every once in a while when a witness is guessing the suspect, it would appear that it was a reduction in correct identifications. But at the end of the day, witnesses who have a clear, strong memory should not be affected by any of these recommendations whatsoever.
And do these proposed changes to police practice offer any protections to law enforcement?
Absolutely. In particular, the recommendation of double-blind administration where, the officer who's conducting the procedure is not aware who the suspect is, it protects the officers involved from any accusations that they influence the witness in their identification, that they perhaps hinted who the suspect is to the witness, encouraging an identification. It completely absolves them from any accusation of kind of wrongdoing in those cases. And of course, if the entire procedure is videotaped or audiotaped, that of course would assist with protecting law enforcement as well.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dysart and Marvin. You have both been so incredibly helpful for us who want to know more about this issue of misidentification and what we can do within the system to prevent it from happening. I want to thank you again for your time and your expertise and sharing your experience.
Thank you.
The Beat was brought to you by the United States Department of Justice COPS Office. The COPS Office helps to keep our nation's communities safe by giving grants to law enforcement agencies, developing community policing publications, developing partnerships, and solving problems.
The opinions contained herein are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. References to specific agencies, companies, products, or services should not be considered an endorsement by the authors or the U.S. Department of Justice. Rather, the references are illustrations to supplement discussion of the issues.